This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's been a year and a half since the Washington Bridge was partially closed, and it'll be years more before it's fully repaired. We talk with the author behind the book, Why Nothing Works, who says this is just another example of a national problem. Government can't accomplish big things anymore. Also, Daniel Davis escaped slavery in Maryland and found his way to Rhode Island in 1862. He became a beloved reverend at a church in Alton. We'll hear about Davis's life and a ceremony at the church next week to honor his legacy. And on Artscape, a look back on our conversation with Chef Sky Kim, the 2025 James Beard Award winner for Best Chef Northeast. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. As part of our ongoing series, Breaking Point, examining Rhode Island's infrastructure woes in the wake of the Washington Bridge fiasco, reporter David Wright recently sat down with Mark Dunkelman. He's a fellow at Brown University's Watson Institute for Public Affairs and author of the best-selling book, Why Nothing Works, Who Killed Progress and How to Bring It Back, which looks at how the government seems to have lost the ability to tackle big things.
For a long time, progressivism in America was about doing big things. The people that ran the Marshall Plan, the people that built the Tennessee Valley Authority, Robert Moses. And we discovered in the 1960s and the 1970s that in many cases, these powerful men weren't always making good decisions. So they were building highways through poor neighborhoods. They were doing urban renewal to clear the slums. They were throwing DDT on crops that created birth defects. They were sending us into the Vietnam War. And in all of these cases, this sort of old progressive establishment was, in the public's view, to blame. And the reaction among progressives was to say, let's put checks on these vast power brokers, these vast wielders of public authority. We've now put so many barriers up that not only have we stopped people from doing bad projects, we've stopped them from doing good ones as well.
In your book, you talk about Massachusetts's efforts to bring electric power down from Quebec. Talk me through that.
Well, in 2016, Charlie Baker signed a bill to subsidize new clean power so that they could green the grid in Massachusetts. Some of it was going to come from offshore wind that would go off Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard, but a lot of it was going to come from hydropower in excess in Quebec.
This is a solution to climate change.
Yeah. The problem was that Massachusetts doesn't have a border with Quebec. So in order to get the power down, they needed to build a new high voltage transmission line from Quebec into Massachusetts through one of the four states, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine. And it's now been nearly a decade. And because of local opposition in those states, there's basically been no way to get the power line through.
What sort of opposition do people raise?
Well, they don't want the line cut through their community. They don't want it to go across the Appalachian Trail. They don't want to ruin the view from a lake. They don't want it to go near their children's schools. They've got all sorts of problems with it. But the broader point is that a project that really shouldn't have taken more than a few months to get done, maybe a year, has taken 10 because of this new regime, that progressivism, wary of big, powerful figures making big discretionary decisions.
I wonder where Donald Trump fits into your hypothesis. Do you think voters are looking to him to be the kind of strongman figure that can get things done?
That's exactly right. The basic story of Donald Trump is that he has recognized that even people who hold progressive values think that the government is incompetent today. And that what we need is somebody who's strong, who's just going to break through it all and not pay attention to the objections from the bureaucracy. I don't think that's true.
I was going to ask, how's that working out in your view?
I think that what's happening is that we've created a world in which bureaucrats, in most cases, and public authority figures don't have the wherewithal to be able to get things done quickly. And so people look at government and say, this is an incompetent institution. They are right about that. It's not because people don't want to get things done, it's because they can't. And so Donald Trump says, with both his behavior and his attitude, I'm not going to stand for any of that, I'm just going to get it done.
As somebody that's been around politics for a long time and has studied this issue in depth, how's he doing?
Well, I think pretty poorly. DOGE managed to fire a bunch of bureaucrats, but left all the processes that the bureaucrats needed to help people work through alone. So Now, you still have to have all those environmental studies done before you can do a big project, but none of the experts in the government who knew how to get the approvals done are there to help. So I think it's going to take longer now to do big projects, to build a highway, to build a high-speed rail line, to build a new electricity grid. All of the expertise we had of people who understood the process are gone, and we're left with just the process.
To get back to that question, though, of people distrusting, for good reason, these authority figures and wanting to throw some checks into the process. In some ways, that's a completely understandable impulse. Where's the balance?
Well, that's the essential question in American democracy, is that you want to have public authority figures who are able to do for us all what we can't do for ourselves, and that means giving them of power and authority. And at the same time, you don't want to give them so much authority that they're able to go rogue.
It's very hard to see a way out of it because the divisions are maybe even deeper now, and the mistrust in authority in many cases comes with good reason.
And it's impossible to imagine a system in which government would be able to be productive again.
But we've done it before, and maybe we can do it again?
That's exactly right. I think that over time, the frustrations that we have with the fact that government isn't able to produce will eventually create a political momentum so that we don't go back to the Robert Moses days, but we at least give authority figures more power to make decisions that aren't universally popular.
Where does Rhode Island fit into all this?
Well, you know, the remarkable thing looking at the Washington Bridge project is that here we are a few years out, and it's still unclear to the public who is ultimately responsible for this debacle. And that's because there's no clear authority of who exactly is in charge, who's responsible.
Well, presumably the Rhode Island Department of Transportation, no?
Yes, but they let contracts in which the risk is shared with the contractors who are doing the work. There are ongoing lawsuits. How did this happen, and how, at this point, do we not have a clear picture? And that reflects a broader trend in the United States where it's just very hard for the ordinary citizen to understand who ultimately makes the decision about where the bridge goes, about where the housing is going to be built. There are so many cooks in the kitchen that it's very hard to delineate who ultimately did something wrong.
But when it comes to these bridges, these are fixed assets, many of which were built in the Robert Moses era. There's been one authority in charge of inspecting them every year and contracting the workers to make necessary repairs. I mean, it's not hard to point a finger of blame, is it?
I don't know enough about the issue to say. I can say that in so many cases in government generally, it's very hard to delineate exactly who did what, when, and why they did it. I don't know the specifics here, but the feeling that people in Rhode Island have now, which is, seems as though no one is accepting responsibility for this disaster, is born from a more general feeling that it's very hard to determine who is responsible for what, when, and where.
Bottom line, it sounds like you have compassion for the Rhode Island transportation officials who are charged with maintaining infrastructure.
My general view is that people in the bureaucracy want to do the right thing and feel constrained.
So the intentions are good, but the roadblocks are real and significant.
Yes.
The book is called Why Nothing Works. Mark Dunkelman of Brown University, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to David Wright. You can catch his story, the latest in our series Breaking Point, Sunday on Rhode Island PBS Weekly, and Monday right here on the Public Radio. We'll be back with more from the Weekly Catch in just a moment. This is the Public Radio. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to the Weekly Catch. Our political reporter Ian Donis joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, always a pleasure.
Hi, Luis.
All right, so the General Assembly session coming down to the wire, what stands out for you?
Well, the top issue is the very hard-fought battle over an assault weapon ban. The Senate Judiciary Committee passed Wednesday what critics consider a watered-down version of the bill. The resolution of this is going to happen after this conversation airs Friday night. So we don't know for now what's going to happen, but it bears watching, and I will be there to report the details for the Publix Radio. Also, the budget is interesting. The $14.3 billion budget passed by the House appears headed for the governor's desk. Rodon is once again in a time of persistent budget deficits, and it's just really hard to wipe out the structural imbalance that propels these annual deficits that need to be cleared each year due to the level of benefits and healthcare spending by the state.
All right, so the legislature is poised to approve a cap on payday lending after a multi-year effort. What turned the tide on this?
It's really the change in Senate leadership. For reasons that are not entirely clear, former Senate President Dominic Ruggiero, who died in April, was unwilling to pass payday lending reform. Now that Val Lawson is Senate President, she has a different approach. And this battle has been going on for about 14 years, but it shows how if you hang in long enough, you can sometimes turn the tide in the General Assembly.
All right, finally, supporters of a bottle bill were disappointed with the outcome on that issue. What happened?
This is kind of the opposite of what happened with the payday lending issue. Bottle bill has been studied for years in Rhode Island. Supporters had come up with a plan that they thought incorporated the view of critics and opponents, but there were business concerns, and the legislature just was unwilling to move ahead. Instead, they kind of punted by having another commission to study the issue that's going to offer some recommendations and findings. So this is an issue that remains in play, and it's going to have to be addressed another day at the State House.
It always ends with a lot of interest. Thanks for the updates, Ian.
Thank you, Lewis.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable or read Ian's TGIF column, out every Friday at 4 p.m. A Maryland man who escaped slavery in 1862 and became a preacher after settling in Rhode Island is being honored next week. Reverend Daniel Davis is buried behind what is now known as St. Thomas Episcopal Church in the tiny mill village of Alton in Richmond. The church is partnering with a nonprofit organization called the Witness Stones Project to place a special marker to commemorate the life of Reverend Davis. Here to tell us more about it is another Reverend, Reverend Bettine Bessier, pastor at St. Thomas Episcopal Church. Reverend, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We're also joined by Carly DeVoe, a sophomore at Cherokee High School. Carly, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating story. Reverend, how would you describe Daniel Davis briefly and how he ended up in Alton?
It is a great story. He, as you mentioned, had been enslaved in Maryland. He originally came to Connecticut and then found his way to Rhode Island. There had been a school for formerly enslaved people in Carolina, Rhode Island, and we know that he attended that school for some amount of time, and then it burned down. We don't know the whole history of that story. We believe that he met his future wife, who was living in Alton at the time, and then they went back to Hartford, where they both worked for hotels or for private families. They eventually came back to Rhode Island. He got ordained. He had their church, we believe, in Providence, also one in Connecticut. He preached all around.
And how did you learn about his story, you personally?
There were a couple of articles in the Cherokee Times, you may know that as a small local paper, about him. So we started digging a little bit because we said, if this man was living a mile behind the church, he must have preached at our church at some time. Because at that time, it wasn't an Episcopal church. It was a mill chapel, non-denominational, just for the mill workers. The mill owners had originally built the chapel for their workers. And then we came to find that he was this unbelievably well-loved preacher in all of, Southern Washington County. So we just kept digging and trying to find more things out about his life and his history and even his wife's family, who some members of her family had also been enslaved.
All right. So on Tuesday, your church is going to be paying homage to Daniel Davis with the help of a group called the Witness Stones Project. Just real briefly, what is this Witness Stones Project and why did you want to get them involved?
They started in Connecticut about 7 years ago. It was a history teacher who wanted to teach his students about people who've been enslaved. And so he took this on as his own project, and it spread like wildfire because many towns in southeastern Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York have found out that there were people who were enslaved, even though I would say history did not always tell them that. So I had heard about Witness Stones Project last year because of an NPR story in Connecticut Public Radio, and I contacted them, and they were very interested in our story. So Witness Stones, they work with local organizations, a lot of churches, a lot of Episcopal churches. Then they try to engage students from the local schools to do research to find out about the history of slavery in their own community. So we've been working with them for several months. And then at the end of this process, they make a little marker that has the person's name. It's just a tiny thing, 4 by 4 inches. And we'll put it on the church grounds to mark where Daniel Davis had preached.
Well, Reverend, you wanted students in the local community to know about the Davis story. That's where Carly comes in. Carly, tell us about this art history project that you did as part of your research into Daniel Davis and the role of formerly enslaved people in Rhode Island.
My class is very small. It's only about 8 or 9 kids. And we kind of split apart and took on different roles in researching. One person did actually, they researched all different headstones of formerly enslaved people in Rhode Island. And then we took a look at like the qualities of Reverend Daniel Davis's headstone and just noticed like, oh, he was so well respected and loved. I took on the role of researching different art installations kind of in the global scene of things that also researched these different historical pasts and confrontations that are bringing individuality to these former enslaved people and giving them like a voice where it really wasn't there before. I thought that these artists who didn't know these former enslaved people personally, you know, still brought a voice to them. And that's kind of what we're doing with Daniel Davis. Like we're bringing a voice to him.
Tell me something that surprised you in your research about Daniel Davis.
So one thing that sticks out to me the most was that in these local papers, when Daniel Davis was seen around town, he would be like in the papers as if it was like a famous celebrity sighting. It was so interesting. We found that out, and everybody, when we found that out, was like, wow, this is crazy, especially because it was these such white areas. He was so idolized.
Carly, think about what you take away from this, but what you hope, you know, your classmates and other young people, anybody will take away from this story.
Well, I hope they take away that there is individuality in everybody. And I think that slavery, when we learn about it, it gets often bunched together as like a whole group of people. And we make the mistake of unconsciously just not really thinking about these people had lives, dreams. And, you know, Reverend Daniel Davis was like, he got an education for himself. He did what he loved. And look at the impact that he made on his community. And I just wish that all of these former enslaved people got to make this much of an impact on the community.
Reverend, you tell me a little bit about Daniel Davis, and I'm wondering, why do you think it's important for your parishioners and the community to know his story?
It was a hidden story, for one thing. We had several events throughout the spring as part of the Witness Stones Project, and people were just shocked who attended. They're like, how have I lived here my whole life and I didn't know any of this? I would say also that the role of the Episcopal Church, especially in Rhode Island, when it comes to slavery, has not been a good story. And we have a bad history in that area. I wouldn't say we're trying to make up for that, but I think that we need to take on a more aggressive role as a church to lift up the lives of people who had been enslaved. Also, because of the times we're in, things are so divisive in this country. This is a great story that brings kind of two communities together. It brings all sorts of people together, and it's a joyful story. That's why it just seemed like the right time right now to pursue the Witness Stones Project.
Carly DeVoe is a sophomore at Cherahoe High School. Also, we spoke with Reverend Bettine Bessier, pastor at St. Thomas Episcopal Church. This is a really cool story. Thank you both for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
We'll be back with more for the Weekly Catch after this break. This is the Weekly Catch. I'm Luis Hernandez, and it's time for Artscape. Every year, the James Beard Foundation recognizes exceptional restaurants and chefs throughout the country, one of the highest honors in the culinary field. Earlier this week, they announced this year's winners. Sky Honnell Kim, the chef at Gift Horse in Providence, won Best Chef Northeast. The win came just a year after Kim was a semifinalist for the Best Emerging Chef. Artscape producer James Bob Gardner talked with Kim at her restaurant, Gift Horse, shortly after she was named a semifinalist in 2024.
I met Chef Sky Kim in the dining room on a recent afternoon, where she told me she draws much of her inspiration as a cook from her upbringing in Korea.
So in my family, we did a lot of like a ceremony, like for ancestor, which is like involve a lot of cooking. My grandma like really into cooking, like fermenting that kind of stuff, because I love eating so much. Like I love my grandma's food. Like I wanted to learn what she does.
When she was 18, Sky started a career as a food stylist, designing fake food for photo shoots. A mentor recognized that she had a talent for it, but said Kim could only truly succeed if she knew how to cook. So Sky signed up for a 3-week cooking school in Italy, where she was in the kitchen for more than 10 hours a day.
So at the end of the day, we make everything, and then like chef tasting what we made that day. He like pointed at me like she need to be cooked, like her food is better than the other. Like after I heard that, like I feel like whole everything has changed. Like but after I went to Italy, like I didn't know that how much I enjoy it, that after I cook and I serve to someone and that person enjoying that food, it's just made me so happy, and like I realized how much I love this.
Shortly after the cooking school in Italy, Kim came to Providence to train as an intern at Birch, a now-closed tiny restaurant that specialized in new American cuisine. It was owned by Ben Sukel, who now owns Gift Horse as well as Oberlin, the restaurant next door. After a couple of years at Birch, Kim went on to work in restaurants in New York City and Portland, Oregon, until she had the opportunity to come back to Providence to work with Sukel at Oberlin. And when Sukel made plans to open a raw bar in Providence, he knew that he wanted Sky Kim to be the chef. I asked Sukel what makes Sky's cooking so different.
Like the confidence Sky exudes when she's cooking is unlike anything I've ever seen. Like in a kitchen, it's just in a kitchen setting. It's literally in her blood, in her DNA from her upbringing, and you can really tell. And you can tell when she's actually, her thoughts now, seeing them on the plates with her own dishes and her own creations, to me is the full circle moment I've always wanted to have.
Kim told me that the inspiration for many of her dishes comes from her grandmother's cooking that she learned as a child.
And sometimes I'm making something, it's made me just happy. It smells like, oh my God, does it smell like my grandma's food right now?
One of those dishes is hui mu chim, which translates to raw mixed fish. The version Kim serves at Gift Horse is inspired by her grandmother, but with a focus on the local, seasonal ingredients available in New England.
Right, so this is it. This is the hui mu chim with sweet potato, with apple, some fluke, and cabbage, and our Gift Horse gochujang.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Of course.
The dish is a delicate arrangement of thinly sliced goodies, giving you so many different tastes and textures that are distinct but work in perfect harmony. She told me that it's similar to what her grandmother made, but not exactly like it.
So what I do here, I twist a little bit, but I don't touch the base. If I touch the base, it's gonna ruin the whole thing. So that's why I like little twists, but not like I wanna keep the base, like big chunk of base in it.
That interview originally aired in March of 2024. Earlier this week, Kim won Best Chef Northeast, a category that includes restaurants from all over New England. I caught up with her this week and asked her what it meant to win the award.
You know, I dreamed this about since like long time ago, like almost like 13, 12 years ago. And I never thought that I'm going to be actually like winning, you know. My goal on at the Gift Horse was going like James Beard, which was this year, was already my dream already came true. And then the winning was, I wasn't not expected.
asked Skye what she's hoping to do next now that she's achieved her dream of winning a James Beard Award.
I mean, in the future, I definitely want to do like a Asian bakery. But right at this moment, I just I don't know yet. I just like try to process this moment first.
You can hear more of my interview with Skye Kim at thepublicsradio.org/artscape. For The Publix Radio, I am James Baumgartner.
Artscape producer James Baumgartner joins me now with a few recommendations for the week ahead. James, what's going on?
Well, this weekend is Pride Fest in Providence. The festival kicks off on Saturday at 11:30 a.m. in District Park. That's near the pedestrian bridge in Providence. And then the parade, which is one of the few nighttime pride parades in the country, it starts at 8 p.m. heading down Dorrance, Washington, and Wabasset streets. There are other LGBTQ plus pride events in the area, like House of Glitter. They have a family pride party on Saturday. This includes mermaid yoga story time, Vogue for Families, and a glitterification station. That's all at AS220 in Providence on Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon. And Saturday also marks World Refugee Day, and the Refugee Dream Center is hosting a celebration including music, arts and crafts, cultural performances, and of course, delicious food. That's at the Refugee Dream Center on Broad Street in Providence on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
A lot of great stuff. Thank you, James.
Thanks, Lewis.
Before we end our show, earlier this month, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a measure to claw back already approved funds for public media across the country. For us, that means losing about 10% of our budget. But it's not over yet. It'll need to pass the Senate to take effect. If you value The Weekly Catch and everything you hear on the Publix Radio, now's the time to show your support. You could do that by making a financial donation, talking with your friends about what public media means to you, and posting on social media with the hashtag #StandShareSupport. You can learn more about ways to take action at protectmypublicmedia.org. That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of the Publix Radio. Our assistant producer is Joe Tasca. Our producer is James Baumgartner. Our editor is Mareva Lindo. Our chief content officer is Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.